We're going to start with our annual, this is the 17th annual Arthur Brown Memorial Reading. We honor the works of Arthur Brown, we carry them on at this event. The late Arthur Brown was a St. Louis poet, recipient of the Missouri Biennial Award for Poetry in 1982, the year that he passed, and the author of three poetry collections, Song of the Sly Mongoose, which was published by Perishable Press in 1981, and the posthumously published A Trumpet in the Morning, which we have about a half dozen copies of on our book table. It is among the last copies of that available. And which was published by River Styx in 1985, and Mississippi River Poems, which was published by Maurice Kenney's Contact II Publications in 1990. His work has also been featured in several anthologies. Most recently that I'm aware of is The Second Set, a collection of jazz poetry edited by Yusef Kumanyaka and Sasha Heifetz. Tonight, the reading features Shirley LaFleur, who is a fixture in the Arthur Brown events and was a close friend and colleague of Arthur Brown's. They worked together in the performance ensemble Free in Concert and went back a long way. And our special guest here is Kyoko Mori, who will be reading in a minute. She was brought to our attention by Shirley LaFleur. The two of them worked together in a event called Tongues of Fire, a celebration of African and Asian culture, which took place this past December in New York. So we were very happy when Kyoko indicated she would be able to come and join us here at River Styx. Ms. Mori was born in Kobe, Japan in 1957 and has lived in the American Midwest since 1977, earning a BA from Rockford College and an MA and PhD in English and Creative Writing from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She's quite prolific, the author of five books, the novels called Shizuku's Daughter and One Bird, two books that are creative nonfiction, a memoir called The Dream of Water, and another book called Polite Lies on Being a Woman Caught Between Cultures, and a collection of poetry called Fallout, which I think she has copies here that will be available at our book table. She's also won several awards for these books. Best Novel of the Year Award from the Wisconsin Council of Writers for Shizuku's Daughter. Her poem Fallout received the Editor's Choice Award from the Missouri Review. And Polite Lies was designated as a book of distinction by the Wisconsin Library Association. I'd like to extend a special welcome to the members of the Brown family who are here and who are on their way. And I'd like you to give a warm welcome to our guest of the evening, Kyoko Mori.
Thank you very much. I want to thank everyone for coming and Shirley for inviting me to share this event with her. I'm going to lower the microphone a little bit here. I'm actually moving in a week. I live in Green Bay, Wisconsin right now, and the moving truck is coming on Monday next week, and I'm going to be moving to Boston. And, so the boxes, moving, all of that is on my mind a lot. So I'm going to start out with a poem about another move that I made about 4 years ago. This was when I was getting a divorce. I was just moving really across town. And as it turned out, my ex-husband and I are great friends. Before I decided to hire the moving truck, he was ready to help me move my stuff to Boston. You know, so we're really good friends. But at the time, you know, it was just kind of sad. And I was thinking about, you know, what does it mean to change your life? My grandmother lived in Japan. She died really some time ago. But I dreamed about her, and the poem begins with that dream. It's called The Chosen Adventure to My Grandmother. The bouquets are large, made of blue flowers only, hydrangeas, forget-me-nots, status, irises, Canterbury bells, flown on a jet from your funeral. They're handed to me in an early morning dream that ends with you, alive, standing on the lawn of my high school. Cousins and aunts, young women in slim dresses, clink glasses of fizzy summer drinks while I lean towards your tanned face. If I never write or call, please remember I loved you all the same. I wake up to a cardinal's slurred two-note call. After the earthquake, even my high school will not be the same. I am slow at coming to terms with this chosen adventure, a friend writes. The first term is giving up of a home, at least temporarily. Boxes crammed into the trunk and the back seat of her car, some stored in a neighbor's attic, many still blocking her doorway. She contemplates the debris of her life. In the house I left, my soon-to-be ex hacks away at the ceiling, scraping plaster and paint, turning the framework of her life into white chalk dust. He wanders outside to mulch the garden that next year will not be his or mine, stakes the blue delphiniums I grew last spring from seed. One night, he calls to invite me for a walk. Just a nice walk, he says, the two of us around our neighborhood. Often, a chosen adventure takes something like faith to stay chosen. Saying goodbye, we insist, I loved you all the same. My dead father calls the Monday after Father's Day, 7 a.m. Finches swarm to the feeder, their small tongues flicking broken hulls from seeds. A garbled sentence ends in a sigh, then a pause. Even dead, he doesn't have a thing to say to me. You have the wrong number, I announce, consigning him to mistakes. I send him back to the gray air, crackling with static. All summer in my dream, I continue my move. One night, I'm packing a glass case of marbles, pinpoints of light trapped inside the shapes of sleep. A week later, I must navigate across the continent with an atlas from which all the numbers have disappeared. The highways have become rivers, fissures in the earth. There's no way home to you, grandmother, regardless of love. I dream your flowers in another language. I always think maps, you know, are fascinating. But then I realized lately, I decided to join the AAA because after the moving truck goes away, my cat and I are going to get into my car, my little two-seater car, and drive all the way from Wisconsin to Boston. So I thought I better get some directions. And they gave me these great maps, you know, with a line drawn and everything. I thought I knew how to read maps because I go, you know, I'm asked to do all these events in Wisconsin and Illinois mostly and sometimes in Minnesota. I get the maps, and I go there, and I thought, I know how to read maps, except these are places I'd been to before. I realize now that I only know how to read maps about places I already know, you know, because the maps kind of confirm what I know, and just the blurry places, like, now, was it Highway 43 or 41? Oh, it's 41, you know, but I know exactly what it looks like when I get there in Milwaukee. Well, when I saw the maps of Ohio, I realized, you know, I don't know if I really know how to read maps. I had to go back to AAA and ask the woman, can you just give me some verbal directions? I just want to know, when you get to Cleveland, you will take such and such highway. Look for this exit. You know, I just don't want to see any pictures. You know, I want words. I think this has something to do with being a poet. You know, I'm visually cute to a certain extent, but when it comes down to it, like I'm on the highway,
cars are coming, exits are coming coming up. I want words. You know, words are really good. So that kind of made me think about that. But transitions are always hard. And even when other people make transitions, you start thinking about your own. This next poem is about visiting the house where my friends lived together after they got divorced. And at the time, my friend Katie, who now is back in Wisconsin, was in New Mexico. And I went to visit the house where she used to live with her husband. And they still had the same flowers. And this seemed like the saddest thing. So this is called Poverty Weed for Katie. Your rosebush is marred this spring by an odd prettiness. Petals grow straight from the knobby joints of branches, a multitude of pale pink cups empty of pollen or calyx. In the raised beds, your plants are up, bull salvias and foxglove, angelica, baby's breath. In the orchard, Dean has grabbed at the apples, using his woodworker's eye to match the grains. The roots of Cortland's are feeding this year's Macs and Spartans as I stand surrounded by Artemisia, sometimes called poverty weed. Out west, where you live, they roam the desert as tumbleweed. They made him homesick the last spring of your marriage. He came back alone last summer and ate the plums as they dried and sweetened week after week on the branches. He and the birds ate them all that way. There were none left to pick. A robin has fallen from a nest on a cottonwood tree. Buster finds it, broken-winged, one leg snap at the joint and bent sideways. For each bird that dies, Dean tells me, 100 more will survive. Except, I argue, your dog didn't bite the 100. I spend the afternoon digging worms in your comfrey patch that needs thinning. Clump after clump comes up with pink worms curled inside woozy roots. I hold them wriggling between chopsticks, and the robin opens his beak so wide I can see clear down inside his throat. He clamps down and shakes his head, swallowing, peeps out a dry whistle. Back in the city, I get up 3 times before dawn to feed him 20 worms in total, while 100 finches sleep in my maples. At the sanctuary, a woman holds him under the light to examine the broken wing, the leg hanging only by thin skin about to break. She shakes her head. No hope, she says, for this little guy. We'll put him down. You can go. I would like him back, I tell her, waving the chopsticks I brought in who knows why. I can feed him until he dies. He won't suffer. I want to show her his hunger, the beak opening up, the muscles inside glistening. I'm sorry, she says. We don't allow that. You can't keep wildlife in your garage. We don't give back any animal that you bring in. She levels her gaze at my eyes and until I turn to leave. On the way home at a gas station, I pitch the chopsticks into the trash while the tank fills up. And I'm suddenly thinking of 3 summers ago, you and me standing in the New Mexico desert among tumbleweed and chimiza, with husbands who'd known each other since the 3rd grade. The sun was setting among the far mountains with names of fruits, sandia, manzano. Glass glittered at our feet from someone's target shooting. What more did we want than that blue calm in the distance of mountains slowly giving themselves up to shadow and the desert so still it might have been a painted backdrop for our changeless lives? I would give anything, Katie, to have them back. Sometimes, though, you know, you change your mind. I mean, you think that, but really you don't think that forever. I'm going to go back to something a little older read a poem from my first collection. And this is kind of why I write, I think. Of course, my ancestors were in Japan. And in Japan, they have this thing where, you know, and I think it's still true, as women grow older, they wear darker and darker colors because they're, you know, meant to be more modest, I suppose. And my mother, who died when I was 12, really resisted this. She really liked bright colors. And when she was 40, and she was supposed to have kind of transitioned into the darker colors, you know, this really depressed her. And I remember that still, and I think about that now and then. This is called To My Ancestral Spirits. They were women who spent 30 years inside gray kimono, quilting the colors they gave up, red and pink of childhood, green and blue of youth, into bridal futon beddings for their granddaughters. They outlasted the men by decades, living on rice and a handful of beans, towards the end growing nothing but white chrysanthemums for the altar. At 40, my mother had a brown coat made, too old now for her peacock blue. She asked the tailor to line the coat with flannel, red and green tartan no one could see. The spring of her death, my aunt folded that coat for storage. Your mother still liked such bright colors, she said, brushing the flannel with her fingers. I stored away that remark among what I wanted to remember most about her. I left my father's house at 20, taking only a few of her possessions, diaries, photographs, a box of jewelry, a sweater. My father's wife waited to burn the rest. Out of the flames, my mother and her mother's rose up, crossed the ocean with me. They asked me now for colors. Through me, they hunger for the yellow of Johnny jump-ups in the maple shade, the blue-purple of morning glories along white fences. On my windowsill, pink geraniums flowered sporadically all winter, random messages from them. Were I at my grandmother's altar, I would offer them a red chrysanthemum, large as my heart, a perfect globe. Chosen by them to live in another land, I offer my words. Their voices name each petal, each leaf vein through me. As you know, there was an earthquake in Kobe some years ago. I mean, ironically, this happened on the day I was in San Francisco. You know, I live in the Midwest where they don't have earthquakes. I mean, they may have tornadoes or something, but never an earthquake. And when I grew up in Kobe, nobody in Kobe thought that there would ever be an earthquake in Kobe. Traditionally or historically, they always have had earthquakes in other parts of Japan, but not in that area. So, you know, we would always like, it was like a joke, you know. And when we did have really minor earthquakes, they were so minor as not to be noticeable. And we would always think like a really big truck must have driven past our house. You know, the shelves would shake a little bit. And later on, it would turn out to be an earthquake, and we would laugh about it. Because of all this, I was actually afraid of earthquakes after I came to the States because of things that happened in San Francisco. Because I saw the, you know, pictures of those freeways that got collapsed. And I thought, I don't know about going to San Francisco to give a reading. I mean, I was only going to be there for 2 or 3 days, though, so I decided that the chance of there being an earthquake there while I was there, you know, pretty small. And then when I was there, I read in the newspaper, or I heard, you know, after the reading I gave, that somebody told me there was supposed to have been this big earthquake in Japan. Even then, I'm thinking it must be, like, in another part of Japan. And the next morning, I was staying at the hotel, and they slipped the newspaper under my door, and I opened it. And Kobe is a fairly large city, but a lot of people don't know where it is. And the particular suburb of Kobe that I came from, Ashiya, of course nobody knows the names of suburbs in, you know, in Japan. I opened the newspaper, and the map of Japan was there, and there was Kobe, Nishinomiya, and Ashiya. And those are the suburbs where I grew up, marked on the map. And I thought, wow, this really did happen in my hometown. No one I was close to was hurt by that. My stepmother, though, her condominium suffered some damage, so... you know, but I wasn't really that close to her, so I don't really care about that. But I did keep dreaming about this earthquake and thinking about it. And I did go to Japan maybe a little bit later, after there had been a lot of, you know, damage had been taken care of. And I still saw some damage. And this is about that, about going back to Japan and trying to kind of assess the damage of the earthquake. But I think it somehow became a metaphor for, you know, the damage of the past. It's called the geometry of loss. The spring after the earthquake, my father's lover came to burn incense at the altar placed in my stepmother's bedroom. Side by side, they bowed before his portrait, the line of gray hair almost unbroken from nape to nape. Outside, wire screens covered the cracked houses, drawing blurred green squares of light around them.
The portrait showed a man too young to fight over, even in memory. Still, drinking tea in the kitchen out of new cups bought since the quake, what did they say to each other? My aunt, who tells me the story, does not know. The lover traveled to Tokyo, to the parks, cafes, and hotels she'd visited with my father through his two marriages, her presence a long line reaching back years before my birth. In my hometown, the past falters in crooked rows of windows. I climb the hill to find our old house inside a green cage. Overhead, pigeons fly in formation, their wings beating scratchy music. In this house, my mother answered midnight calls from one woman, then the other, weeping my father's name from two cities. Collapsed walls preserve the shapes of her misery. In a cemetery in Tokyo the next morning, three women are gathered at a gravesite. The tallest, long hair flecked with gray, chants and stabs the air with her finger as if scolding the dead. A few feet behind her, the others pray, heads bowed. White eyes feed in the branches above, flicking their green wings open, shut, the way card players fan their secrets. Outside the walls of the cemetery is the city where my father's lover walked her pilgrimage, dropping a postcard to my stepmother out of spite or foolishness. Not one place holds his memory for me in all of Japan. My steps stir up the baubles into the dark fur like a handful of bad fortune. A stranger to these dead, I sprint past their identical squares of grief, leaving behind the pale outlines of loss. The next couple of poems are, pardon me? Thanks. The next couple of poems are sort of about belief, I think. I have a friend who's a priest, and it took him a long time to be a priest. He's in his 40s. He's only been a priest for like 2 or 3 years. And he's also an artist. And he doesn't look like a priest, though. One time we were in Chicago, he really looks like a J. Crew model. That's what he looks like. One time when we were in Chicago, he wanted to show me this cathedral that he used to go to. And, you know, we knocked on the door, and another priest opened the door. And my friend said, I'm a Catholic priest, and I wanted to show my friend this cathedral where I used to, you know, come all the time. He was wearing this denim jacket and everything. He wasn't dressed like a priest, my friend. The other priest looked at him, and he said, you can come into the church even if you're not really a priest. And the most remarkable thing about this was that, you know, I didn't have this outrage. No, he's a priest. You know, when my friend said this thing about being the Catholic priest, I just had this sinking feeling that I used to get when I was young and my friends told bad lies. I had kind of forgotten that he was. But in some ways, he's very committed to that, you know, to being a Catholic priest. And sometimes I envy him because I don't quite know what I believe in. So this is a poem about trying to kind of figure that out. It's called Gathering Altar Flowers for Jim Nielsen. One. In October, Queen Anne's lace bends the way lampposts do on old streets, each flower becoming a birdcage of stars, vaguely Victorian. I choose the tallest for the altar, though I am years past believing. My friend, a month from his ordination, points to the white crosses behind the abbey, double rows regular as paper cuts. Someday I will be there, he says, while our scissors close on the stems of goldenrod and purple loosestrife. We're the same age. I am nowhere near the stone of my ancestors to touch their names with thin fingers of incense. My cousins appear in dreams as children we stopped being decades ago to tumble down hillsides into the river. They swim like the frogs we once pretended to be. The same asters grow here, the deep purple of old ribbons. We carry them on stretched arms, pencil imprints of leaves scarring our skin. Overhead, blackbirds gather, a handful of letters speeding toward conclusion across the darkening sky. Two. When another friend mentions wine being poured on the ground after the service, wine used in the communion not to be returned to the bottle or discarded in kitchen sinks, I know the hushed footsteps of white-robed children from the sacristy to the churchyard, where the liquid disappears into particles of sand. Groomed bushes surround them like large dogs, clumsy and friendly with heads down. On the edge of the playground, empty swings line up into the equation of minus signs. The wind rides all Sunday long. The sum total of what I still believe is in the arrangement. Between the branches of dogwood, peacock feathers float on silver stems thin as piano wire, each dark eye slowly giving way to lighten into gold. I believe the colors I cannot name between the center and the edge. My friend, now a priest, is wearing a black wool coat found in the basement of his abbey. Inside the lapel, the thumb-sized satin tag is marked in black ink with a tailor's registered number and the year, 1954. Standing among the empty pews, I trace the stitches set down straight and even by a treadle sewing machine 3 years before our mothers could imagine us, accept us abstractions, vague hopes at best. At his first mass, my friend prayed for his mother who died in faith. If I could, I would pray for mine who believed nothing more than I do now, the floating hearts of peacock feathers and perfect seams, this code of arbitrary beauty. There's a place in New York, the Cloisters. It's uptown, kind of facing the Hudson. And I went there to, it's like a medieval, cloisters, kind of reconstructed from pieces of actual cloisters from Europe. And they have medieval paintings and sculptures and, things in there. I went there with a friend, and this is about, what I saw. It's called Lovers at the Cloisters. On the limestone capitals, the acanthus leaves curl outward, thick, spiny, full of drilled holes, as if some light or darkness emanated from the center. They are the leaves of knowledge or desire, the honeycomb pattern of the holes dripping with sweetness, though above on the architrave, small carved heads grow on the stem ends of vines, their eyes and mouths wide open, while their throats constrict into a swirling tendril of ornamentation. In the narrow corridor that flanks the cloister garden, two lovers are seated on a wooden bench, their long black coats unbuttoned, their arms around each other's waist. They lean together in a tight embrace. In the gray light from the windows, it is hard to tell where one garment ends and the other begins. Wrapped inside a warm, dark skin, the lovers are kissing. The tip of his tongue slowly traces the curve of her mouth. They're trying to form a new word together, their lips pressing soft, then hard, a sudden breath taken and held. Neither young nor old, they are noticing nothing except this word entering them. The rain that falls on the rose hips in the garden flickers in their hair, her upturned face, the delicate vein of his forehead. In another room, the saints wear their halos like golden plates behind their heads, even in the scenes of crucifixion and burial, or inside their fishing boat sinking on a stormy night. Arms outstretched in distress toward Christ, who is apparently walking away from them on the waves, the apostles wear their crowns of light, a treasure possessed, though unknown. Outside in the rain, seven cardinals scatter among the lattice work of bare branches in a low bush, three male and four female. Their wings are the same bright tint as those of the angels in the illuminated manuscripts in the treasury. The lovers stand under the quince trees overlooking the Hudson. Already at five, the lights are on over the bridge. They're old enough to be saddened by this. It has taken them half a lifetime to meet. Their hands clasped, fingers laced together, they walk toward the train station. Standing in the darkened core of the subway, they will kiss, their eyes closed inside the soft shelter of long coats, and feel the train pitch them sideways and back with the unmistakable speed of desire. Gladly, they will fall into an endless well of dark water while the noise around them becomes a thick forest of interlocking leaves, an impenetrable canopy of fabric and stitches. And then the next few poems are about art, which I think is kind of like religion. A friend of mine told me that when he was a little younger, he was on this crew and of artists who installed monsters in this, I guess, Hall of Fame of retired monsters or some such thing. And the whole thing was financed by the rock artist Bon Jovi. And there was just this handful of artists who went to Wildwood, New Jersey to do this, and a lot of tradesmen. They were like carpenters, union workers. And this was off-season, and there was really nothing to do. There were two bars that were open, and, you know, they were pretty boring places. So all the carpenters went there to get drunk every night. The artists did this for a while. They were there for a week, though, and they got tired of that. And they had these great tools. So they decided to vandalize their rooms, you know, probably in honor of rock artists who probably did that all the time. But they decided to do it subtly, you know, so that they wouldn't be charged. So they took, you know how hotel rooms always have really bad pictures? So they took the pictures out and improved them and put them back. They cut off the, you know, the legs of things just a little bit, so things were just a little bit tilted, but nobody would know, you know, stuff like this. When they told me, you know, when this guy told me this story, I was stuck in a hotel room in Iowa. I went there for some gig and I couldn't leave because of a blizzard, and I was at a Holiday Inn. And this is why this came up. And I had this beading kit. You know, I was making this beaded necklace. And I decided that in honor of the story that this friend had told me, I sold some beads in the back of the Holiday Inn chair. But nobody noticed that either. And that wasn't quite enough, so I decided to write a poem about it. So this is called When the Artists Left Town. When the artists left town with their tools and brushes, the pictures on the walls of their hotel rooms began to change. One day, the road stopped in the middle of the field, no longer leading to the red barn in the distance. A week later, the tame white geese in the pond by the trees were discovered to have the curved necks and dagger-shaped bills of herons. Their appetite for corn and grass forgotten, they stirred the mud bottom with yellow feet and waited to spear the small frogs that surfaced. For years, guests suffered from vertigo, catching the fragile blooms of their wine glasses on the table's edge or putting down the heavy water goblets in mid-air. No one ordered room service or slept well. All dreamed of falling headlong into a vortex of wind or feet first away the dead slide into the fire, and the beds tipped sideways work love spells, pitching some pairs clinging together to the right, separating the others as they rolled left, always reversing the pattern of who turned away, who held on. Across town, the retired monsters a heavy metal store had hired them to install in a museum greeted us season after season in good cheer, raising the stiff plaster arms, swinging their fabulous heads of wild hair. This next poem was written about visiting the Art Institute in Chicago. It's about 4 hours from where I live now. And, you know, every time I go back there, I notice things that I noticed before, but I look at it kind of some more in a sort of different way. And I was looking at that wing that had been closed for, you know, years, and then finally renovated, which is a modern, you know, sort of contemporary wing. And the museums are always interesting because you usually go through them in a chronological order. You know, so you feel like you're going through this whole history, and at the same time, you're sort of going through the history of who you were and who you are now. This is called Suffering. Suffering at the Art Institute of Chicago. In the small upstairs gallery where the centuries change, the doorway behind me flickers with the orange and gold light from the haystacks. The swirling blue sky that embraces the drinkers as they tip their glasses, and the yellow island turning into geometric planes of pure color, are only a few steps around the corner. But I'm walking toward the dark bronze sculpture cast in 1907 by Brancusi. It is a bust of a child who leans away from the light, eyes closed, head shaved, the sharp bone of the jaw pressed against the right shoulder. Cut off a few inches below that shoulder, what remains of the arm resembles a wounded bird or plucked fruit, an object far beyond consolation, though it is cradled against the tender skin of the throat. The left ear tilted up into the empty air, the child strains to hear some music that will never come. The right ear turns inward, tries to burrow into a dark place between the muscle and the bone, where the warmth of our own skin can only fail to comfort us the way a lover's might. The sculpture is called suffering. Do you remember it? We pause a few seconds before moving further into our century, where hand in front of the Cornell boxes, we peered into small squares of light. The same paper ballerina is still poised in mid-leap across the bottomless well of blue shadows. The white owl stares, backlit and formidable among seashells and fungi. Alone in a quiet gallery, I push the button that lights up the boxes. It is a small gesture of hope, trust, or curiosity, the simple wish to see. The green parrots, the blue hotels, the mysterious maps and timetables, they cannot assuage your suffering except in the way a sudden color flashes across your memory like a stubborn Morse code. I am out here in the mid-century before our birth, my fingers tapping the light switch to send you a message. On the other side of the glass, our favorite birds are beckoning. As surely as we're born into suffering, we're meant also for this. This is the last poem. And the last poem is about, it's another museum piece. In New York last summer, I went to see the Pierre Bonnard show. And, you know, Bonnard was actually my mother's favorite painter. I grew up in Japan. But the thing about the Impressionists, everybody likes them, you know. And I think I have this new insight, though, about why everyone likes them. I went out with my former in-laws last week. Because I'm leaving town, everyone's taking me out to dinner. And I'm still good friends with my ex-husband and my ex-in-laws. So they decided to all take me out to dinner. And Mary and Dick, my former parents-in-law, they went to Paris last year. And, you know, of course, they went to the Louvre. And Chuck, my ex, and I were asking, so how was your trip, you know? And Mary said, you know, I really enjoyed the Louvre, but really, after a while, I just got sick and tired of, like, too many people stabbing each other in those paintings. You know, I think she was talking about the 17th, 18th, and early 19th century historical paintings of these great battles and stuff. And I started thinking, no wonder people like the Impressionists. After centuries of people stabbing each other in these paintings, you know, to come upon people gardening, you know, sitting around having a picnic, you know, walking up the stairs. I mean, that's just really kind of a soothing thing. So I got this new insight about that. But really, the colors are, you know, amazing. And I like the thing about Bonnard, and he was kind of known for, you know, painting from memory. I mean, even though they were scenes from his own life, he would always keep improving them and changing them, or he would start a painting and it would get finished after the subject had passed away. He did a lot of nudes of his wife, who, and I think some of those were finished after she died. So I thought about that, and I also thought about how, you know, how I have kind of learned to look at things. It's called Painting from Memory, Pierre Bonnard, The Bathroom, 1932, which is a particular painting. And it begins with a quote of Pierre Bonnard himself. There's a formula which fits painting perfectly. Many little lies create a great truth. That's what he said. The room is on a grid, its horizontal and vertical lines supplied by a large door with shutters, the square tiles on the wall, the small table with a long-necked bottle on it, the blue diamond-shaped tiles on the floor parallel, the slanted positioning of the bathtub, and the shadow which cuts the door in half, all the diagonal lines tilting together to the right. What is skewed is meticulously ordered. From left to right, the light changes from blue to orange, a shaft of gold embracing the figure on the round orange mat, more a ball of light. And sitting on a white rug, the amorphous shape of a spilled milk, a red-haired dog. They're drawn loose and round, except for the vertical lines of her legs that echo the downward strokes of the curtains behind them. The world is fixed on a grid, but we are not. We are the blurred colors moving through the precise geometry of time and space, like this woman who bends forward at the waist, her skin a soft confusion of brown and purple, as she steadies herself on the rim of a sink that resembles an ice sculpture. The edge of the bathtub, with its wide, curved lip, its leg chubby as infant's knee, occupies the lower left corner. The tilt of the woman's body continues a line from the tub, as if the two were balanced, equidistant from the center. All we see is a fraction of the tub. The composition crops off the rest, letting it complete its shape in the empty space beyond the picture plane. This is a tub she will step into 10 years later in her last portrait, her body blue and cadaverous, elongated by the play of water and light, the tub stretching as if to accommodate her form, the walls flashing yellow, purple, green. By then, the blue diamonds of the floor tiles will have become round dots, and the dog, aged and grown darker, will sit on a square mat as if already framed by memory or grief. But for now, the world, though fixed, is rippled in waves of color, and the red dog is a figure of joy, solid and centered on the floor, as the woman steps right foot forward into a circle of light. Thank you.